You've got to take every opportunity. You're about to miss the baby boat. There's that bossy, big sisterly tone Claire adopts whenever she talks to Sophie about her love life, or lack thereof. She herself has been in a long-term relationship for 11 years and doesn't want children because she and her partner have a lifestyle, which means they go on trekking holidays and have white wool carpet. However, she is very respectful of Sophie's desire to have children, maybe a bit too respectful, because she is vigilant about Sophie slacking off on her man-hunting. She doesn't believe in fate or destiny or that Mr. Right will turn up when you least expect it. She believes that finding a man to be the father of your children before your fertility drops to zero is no different from any other goal, like finding the right car or the right property. Sophie sighs and pulls another hanger out of her cupboard. Don't you think it's a bit too much to expect Aunt Connie to provide me with both a house and a man, as if she's my fairy godmother? You're the one who says I think life is a frigging fairy tale. Put the sexy black number on, Cinderella. Veronica rings Sophie again the night before Aunt Connie's funeral. Tell me you don't have the gall to come tomorrow. I thought you weren't saying another word to me in your entire lifetime. You're not welcome. You're not family. Gosh, Veronica, says Sophie sweetly. I thought I was like your family. I seem to remember you making a speech about how I was like the sister you never had. Naturally, Sophie had been Veronica's bridesmaid. It is cruel and bitchy of her to remind Veronica of her wedding to Jonas when it had ended so quickly in divorce, but this is getting tedious. May I remind you that it was at my wedding that you got together with my brother? I don't deny it, but what's the relevance? The relevance is that you rejected him. You rejected our family, and now you think you can waltz back in. Miss Butter wouldn't melt in my mouth. She means you rejected me. Sometimes Sophie thinks she'd hurt Veronica more than she'd hurt Thomas. Veronica had been ecstatic when Thomas and Sophie got together. If Sophie is honest with herself, and oh, how she strives to be honest with herself, Veronica's effusiveness is probably one of the reasons why she had to break up with her brother. There is something about Veronica that makes Sophie want to fold her arms tightly across her chest and say, "You can't have any more of me." Sophie has an irrational dislike of Veronica's intense interest in the most trivial details of her life. She remembers everything, as if she is stockpiling ammunition to prove what? That she knows Sophie better than she knows herself? She would say in front of other friends, "Oh no, that date is no good. Sophie wouldn't be able to come. It's the third Thursday. It's her dinner night with her parents. They rate restaurants, you know." She remembered what books, food, and movies Sophie did and didn't like. Sophie hates tortellini. Sophie loved that movie. Why do such innocuous comments aggravate Sophie so much? It feels like if she spends too much time with Veronica, there will be nothing left of her. She's like a vampire sinking her fangs into Sophie's neck and sucking her dry. I thought you'd forgiven me for breaking up with Thomas. Sophie softens her voice because Veronica just wants to be her friend, that's all. She's not really a vampire. I thought you said it was time to move on. Veronica ignores that. I bet you are trying to get your claws into Aunt Connie at my wedding. Sophie is outraged. What? I barely spoke to her. Connie had been far too busy having a good time, remembers Sophie. Her husband Jimmy had still been alive. They had danced the Charleston, an elderly white-haired couple who still somehow managed to flutter their fingers and kick in perfect timing, crossing their hands across their knees and giving Sophie a split-second glimpse of the vibrant young couple they had been. Everybody had applauded madly. They were gorgeous. Veronica switches topics again. Look, you're just going to upset people by turning up tomorrow. Mum, Grandma, Enigma, Aunt Rose, none of them wants you to be there. Veronica, your Aunt Rose phoned me today to ask if I was coming. There is silence, which is so unlike Veronica that Sophie thinks they must have been cut off. Veronica? Her voice is strained. I don't believe you. Of course. The worst betrayal for Veronica is when she is left in the dark about something. And now Sophie is back to feeling guilty because Veronica is right. She isn't part of their family. She has a handful of memories about Aunt Connie when Veronica has a whole lifetime. It isn't fair. Sophie has charmed an old lady into leaving her a house. It doesn't matter that it wasn't deliberate. It's wrong. I'm sorry, Veronica, she says. Veronica's voice is full of icy, righteous hurt. I'm sorry I ever met you. Chapter 16. Do we tell Sophie the truth about Alice and Jack? Do you think that's what Connie would have wanted? Yes, I think so, but not until she's 40, just like the others. How old do you think she is? I don't know, they all look about 12 to me. Chapter 17. Did Alice and Jack Munro deliberately abandon their baby, knowing that Connie and Rose would stop by and that their family could give the baby a better start in life than them? Surely not. It was far too boring an explanation, and luckily it didn't account for the boiling kettle, the marble cake, or those satisfyingly mysterious bloodstains on the kitchen floor. And why not opt for the simple baby-left-on-doorstep solution? Did Jack kill Alice in a fit of rage because he hated marble cake, dump the body, and leave the baby to die? Or did Alice kill Jack in a fit of rage because he said something derogatory about her marble cake, dump the body, and leave the baby to die? Certainly the diary found in the 70s would suggest something along those lines. Did the baby kill Alice and Jack? The last one was 10-year-old Veronica's suggestion, made on the beach one day to Thomas and Grace, who fell about laughing, imagining the baby, their grandma Enigma, leaping out of its cot to strangle Alice and Jack with tiny hands. It is the day before Aunt Connie's funeral, and Grace is bathing her baby and thinking about the mystery of her great-grandmother, Alice Munro. Grace hates bathing the baby. When he is dressed and wrapped tightly in a rug, he is a solid, manageable football. But when he is naked, he is all flimsy and breakable, skinny legs all bent up at angles like an uncooked chicken. The fragility of his tiny limbs makes her feel sick. He seems to know how horribly vulnerable he is when he is naked, because the moment she starts undressing him, he screams and screams, which does something to her brain like the shrieking scrape of nails across a blackboard. When she holds him in the bath, his legs and arms thrash. The possibility of drowning him seems more likely than not. It is as if the point of each bath is to save him. She feels that her nails, although she deliberately keeps them short and filed, will surely tear his purplish, paper-thin skin. Of course, Callum loves bathing Jake. Grace could let him do it every day, but she has the feeling that she is on some sort of treacherous journey, and if she stops, even for a moment, then she might never get up again. It is better to just go doggedly on and on. Grace wonders how Alice Munro had bathed her baby. It had been winter when they vanished, just like now. The island gets very cold. Alice didn't have hot water or electricity or warm gas heating. No TV to blank out her mind while she was breastfeeding. No CDs to drown out the sounds of a silent house. No refrigerator. No washing machine. No dryer. No gleaming white goods at all. They had been very short of money, like everyone. "You children have no idea," Aunt Connie used to say. "You think terrible things happened on the battlefields, but terrible things happened in ordinary suburban homes." Jack was unemployed. 70 years later, their combined savings of 2 shillings and 6 pence are still sitting in the tin on the shelf above the sink. Guests on the Alice and Jack tour are allowed to peer in the tin as it is rattled under each nose by the tour guide. "No need to rattle quite so loudly, Veronica," Aunt Connie would say. Grace can't imagine how her great-grandmother coped. Although, then again, in the light of what happened, maybe she hadn't. She'd made a marble cake, though. That was indisputable. That indicated coping, didn't it? Well, of course it didn't. You can still bake a perfectly good cake while losing your mind. Grace remembers watching Aunt Margie in her kitchen efficiently grating lemon rind for a lemon meringue pie while she cried great wrenching sobs over her father's cancer diagnosis. Aunt Margie had been closest to Grandpa out of any of them. Who knows what thoughts were going through Alice's mind while she baked that marble cake? Did she know it was the last cake she'd ever bake? Grace takes the baby from the bath and lays him on his back on the change table. At least he can't roll over yet. When he learns to roll over, he'll be in even more danger. He'll be like a slippery glass ball. Just thinking about it gives her a drilling sensation behind her eyes. What did Alice think of her new baby girl? Was she besotted with her, like a mother should be? It's strange, really, that she's never thought much about the fact that she is Alice Munro's great-granddaughter. It had been hard enough for Grace and her cousins to get their heads around the fact that grey-haired Grandma Enigma was the same person as the tiny abandoned baby who had smiled so sweetly at Aunt Connie and Aunt Rose. Alice Munro never seemed particularly real, or even that interesting to Grace. It was Veronica who was forever coming up with new and more macabre solutions to the mystery. She clicks together the press studs on Jake's pale green baby grow suit, buttoning him back up into a standard, cared-for baby with a standard, caring mother. She wonders if the something that held her great-grandmother together, the something that kept her neat and tidy and allowed her to get out of bed each day and bake marble cakes, had been loosening, moment by moment, pulling and straining until one day her husband said or did something quite innocuous and it snapped. The real snarling, biting, furious Alice was unleashed with terrible consequences. Grace wonders if that propensity to snap had been encapsulated in a gene that is now floating around in her own DNA. She wonders if perhaps it would be more sensible to take action before that gene has a chance to hurt anyone. After his bath, Jake falls into a deep, drugged sleep halfway through his feed. She puts him down and looks at him, dispassionately. He is a very good, obedient baby. He's doing everything as per the books that Thomas's wife, Debbie, has lent her. Before Jake was born, Grace had visited Thomas, Debbie, and baby Lily at their spotless West Ryde home. There were children riding bikes up and down the street, and the smell of freshly mown grass. Debbie served them homemade Anzac biscuits. Thomas showed her their new pergola. There was a tangible sense of relief emanating from Thomas. It was as though all his life these achievements, home, wife, baby, had been weighing heavily on his mind, and now he'd finally checked them all off, he could relax and benignly observe the rest of the world still flailing about, trying to reach their own little islands of security. "Sophie is still single, you know," he told Grace sadly, without a trace of triumph, just ponderous concern. The chances of having a Down syndrome baby increase every year after the age of 35. She really needs to hurry up. Debbie began a hefty percentage of her sentences with the phrase, "I'm the sort of person who..." Debbie was the sort of person who could instantly and accurately judge a person's character, and she could tell that Grace was going to be a wonderful mother. Debbie was the sort of person who believed knowledge was power. That's why she had bought so many books on good parenting. Debbie was the sort of person who didn't mind at all lending her books to someone like Grace, who was family, but she was the sort of person who would like to get them back in good condition. Debbie was the sort of person who had a very high tolerance for pain, but when she was in labor, it was like being torn in two and she screamed so loud that she burst a blood vessel in her eye. Debbie was the sort of person who didn't really like kids, but the moment she saw her daughter, Lily, she felt the most euphoric feeling, the most intense love she had ever felt. "I fell instantly in love with her," said Debbie. "I'm the sort of person who doesn't exaggerate, and honestly, truly, it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. I just adored her. I'd give my life for her. I'd throw myself in front of a semi-trailer for her. I just sobbed when she was born, didn't I, Tommy? You'll see. It will be the same for you. It happens to every mother." 3 months later, at 4 in the morning, Grace saw her baby son for the first time. The midwife, a snappy, skinny girl who Grace hated, put him on her stomach. Grace waited for the euphoria. Instead, she felt the most intense sensation of nothing. She didn't like or dislike this greasy creature. He was a stranger, nothing to do with her. All she could feel was relief that it was over, that it was out of her, that nobody was shouting instructions at her anymore. She has her own labor story now, but she can't imagine cheerfully sharing it with anyone, like Debbie had done, in excruciating detail over Anzac biscuits. It had been, quite simply, grotesque. She had lost all control of herself, her mind and her body, and she never wanted to again. "He's so small!" Callum was standing next to the bed in a white hospital gown, pale and red-eyed. There was some blood on his gown. He looked like a doctor on ER. Grace saw her husband's face all scrunched and silly with joy. So he was feeling it. She thought perhaps the euphoria was running late, and it would eventually hit her. One day she'd look at her son and fall in love with him, like a proper mother. But Jake has been in the world now for 3 weeks, and Grace is beginning to wonder, with a sort of tired inevitability, if she will never feel anything except the enormous responsibility of keeping his tiny heart beating, his tiny lungs breathing. It seems she might have to fake it for the rest of her life. She imagines him taking his first steps, dressed for his first day of school, playing his first soccer game, standing up all awkward and gangly to do a speech at his 18th birthday party. And all the while, there would be Grace, his fraudulent mum, becoming greyer and wrinklier, and still not feeling it. She watches Jake sleeping and says out loud, "Well, Debbie, guess what? I'm the sort of person who can't love her own child." As Grace is walking back down to the kitchen, she begins to cry. She feels somehow separate from her crying, as if her body is experiencing a series of involuntary symptoms, a salty discharge from her eyes, a convulsing chest. It continues on until she is mildly astonished. She didn't know it was possible to cry for so long. Eventually, she decides it isn't necessary to stop functioning just because she is crying. She should just get on with what she needs to do. She sobs as she does a load of washing and wails into the cold wind as she puts the washing on the line. She fries mince for Callum's favourite meal, lasagna, and lets the tears slide off the edge of her chin and into the sizzling meat. "Oh, this is ridiculous," she thinks. "That's enough now." She doesn't want to be all puffy and red-nosed when Callum comes home. She wants dinner in the oven, a CD on the stereo, a sleeping, buttoned-up baby in his crib, and a nice bottle of red wine already opened. She wants everything calmly in place, like the way she imagined it would be before the baby was born. She wants to be good at this. Being a mother is just like any other new skill, like driving a car or playing tennis. At first, it seems impossibly difficult, but then, by gritting your teeth and trying again and again, you get your head around it. She just has to get her head, her stupid, aching head, around this new skill. When Callum had got home after his first day back at work, he'd found Grace deeply asleep on the couch. He'd touched her arm, and she had apparently said, without opening her eyes, "Look, all you need to do is add 2 eggs. It's not rocket science," before rolling over and going back to sleep again. Callum had found this very amusing. She had heard him telling his mother about it on the phone, sounding very loving and husbandly. "Very tired, of course," she heard him say. "But no, she's fine." "Stop talking about me as if I'm a retarded child," she wanted to scream. His mother was so nice. He was so nice. He'd cooked dinner, microwaved some leftovers and made a salad with a great deal of stirring and clattering and leaping around the kitchen as if he were cooking a 3-course meal, but still. And even packed the dishwasher and wiped bench tops without being asked while she breastfed the baby. It had all made Grace feel unreasonably aggravated. He seemed so happy. He was doing everything right, and he hadn't even been the one who particularly wanted children. It was Grace who had pushed for the baby. Why had she done that? It seemed to be more to do with the fact that she didn't see herself as the sort of person who would choose not to have children than the fact that she actually wanted to be a mother herself. She didn't identify with those people who talked about not having children as a lifestyle choice. There was something suspicious about people who seemed so proud of going against convention. Grace saw nothing wrong with convention. That's why, when she turned 33, she decided it was about time she and Callum had children. Not the best reason for having a child, she thinks now. Surely a reprehensible reason. To have a child just because he didn't want to be the sort of person who didn't have one. Oh, her head. Her poor papier-mâché head. The meat spatters oil on the white tiles behind the cooktop, and Grace immediately wipes them clean with a paper towel, as though her mother isn't thousands of miles away on the other side of the world. Turkey, according to the typed 15-page itinerary hanging on the cork notice board next to the fridge. But she could walk back into the room at any moment. She wipes her eyes with the paper towel and thinks how repulsed her mother would be by this excessive crying. "Don't be a drama queen, Grace," her mother used to say when she cried as a child. She goes to the pantry for the spices and stops to look out the window with watery eyes. Her mother's house, like all the houses on the island, is built up high on a block of land sloping gently to the waterfront. All the windows along the front of the house have views of the river. It is twilight, and the sunset is turning the river bronze. All their friends turn into real estate agents the first time they see this view. Stunning! Panoramic! Breathtaking! "You grew up with this view," they say to Grace. "I bet you just took it for granted. I bet you never even looked at it, huh?" Actually, she did used to look at it. Sometimes for hours at a time, sitting at the window and imagining a boat appearing at the house jetty with her father in it. "I'm back," he'd say cheerily. "Sorry I took so long." Her father had left when Grace was a baby. "A lot of abandoning of babies in my family," she'd told Callum when they were sharing family histories. Except there was no mystery about Grace's father. He was a dentist who fell in love with his dental nurse and moved to Perth. When Grace was a child, she assumed that the first thing her father would look at when he came back to collect her would be the state of her teeth. So she brushed them so rigorously that her dentist told her she was wearing away the enamel. She still thinks of her father whenever she flosses. She flosses religiously, twice a day. Her teeth are perfect. As she watches the river, she hears the putt-putt of an engine, and a boat does appear, trailing a wide curve of whitewash. It is Callum, sitting very straight, one hand behind him on the tiller, the sky all fluffy orange and pink, like something in a religious poster. She can't see his face, but she knows he'll be smiling. Shit, 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 he's early. She can't even complain about her husband working long hours and not being supportive, for Christ's sake. She doesn't want him home just yet. The lasagna is not in the oven. She is still crying. She turns around from the window and her elbow knocks against the bowl she's been using to mix up the tomatoes and spices. It falls in slow motion to the floor. There is time to catch it, but she just stands there stupidly, as if she wants her mother's good china mixing bowl to shatter violently on her flawless white kitchen tiles. With comic timing, the baby begins to cry, louder than she's ever heard him cry, as if he's been crying for hours. "Please don't say anything," says Grace without turning around when she hears Callum come into the kitchen behind her. She stands looking at the mess in front of her. He silently tiptoes past her to get the broom. Later that night, after they've eaten the lasagna and watched TV and packed the dishwasher and given Jake his 10 p.m. feed, Grace's mother calls from Istanbul. Grace sits down on the hallway floor with her legs straight out in front of her and drums her fingers against her thigh. Callum says he can tell whenever she's talking to her mother. "You become very still and alert," he says, "like a commando." She carefully tries to sound like a daughter, not a commando. "Hi, Mum." "Oh, my word." Her mother's voice is clear and sharp in her ear. "It's a very good line. You sound like you're next door." "Oh, my word," is a favourite phrase of Laura's own mother, Grandma Enigma. It is the first time Grace has ever heard her mother use it. Perhaps everyone is turning into their mothers. "So, Istanbul, are you having fun?" she asks. Her mother answers in a rush of words. She sounds slightly manic. "Well, yes and no. The food, for example, is quite inedible. It's swimming in oil. I'm eating nothing but tomato. The tomatoes are all I can stomach. Still, that's a good thing. I ate far too many carbohydrates in France. How is your weight, by the way? It took me 6 months to get back to my pre-pregnancy weight after you. I haven't weighed myself. Well, the scales are right there in my bathroom. You need to be vigilant about your weight. Look what happened to Margie. She blew up like a balloon while she was pregnant with Veronica and stayed that way. She wore a size 20 to your wedding. I checked the label on the jacket when she went to the bathroom and I nearly had a fit. Size 20. She looked fine to me, says Grace. Oh, don't be ridiculous. She's monstrous. Poor cuddly Aunt Margie. Grace thought she'd looked quite uncomfortable in that blue suit. She probably should have had a size 22. She says, so, but apart from the food, you're enjoying yourself? Her mother's voice drops and becomes almost emotional. Oh, Grace, you can't imagine the state of the toilets. In some of them, you have to squat right down on the ground. It was the most horrific experience of my life. Surely you've had worse experiences than squatting on a toilet, thinks Grace. How about your husband leaving you for his dental nurse? Or your father dying of cancer? Good for your thighs, comments Grace. Squatting? Laura brightens. Yes, that's a point. Have you bought a rug? Asks Grace. Oh, yes, I've done the tourist thing. Sleazy men ran around giving us all apple tea. So sugary sweet. Terrible. I bargained as well as I could. No doubt they were laughing their heads off at the price I paid. I probably won't be able to get it through customs back in Sydney. I wouldn't blame them. I'm sure it's not hygienic. Is it nice and hot? Tries Grace. It's very cold here. Oh! The heat, the humidity. I'm so dehydrated. Terrible. Right, says Grace. She doesn't really understand why her mother is taking this world trip. She doesn't seem to be enjoying it at all. It's like she is forcing herself to undergo one of her more rigorous diet and exercise regimes. She says, Mum, I'm afraid I've got some bad news. But Laura doesn't seem to hear her. How is Jake? She asks urgently. For a moment, Grace can't think who Jake is. Her mother said the baby's name in such a grown-up way. He's fine. Grace feels a dead feeling in her stomach. Beautiful. Breastfeeding okay? Yes, I didn't breastfeed you. I couldn't stand the thought of it. I remember saying to Margie, I'm not a cow. I'm not a pig. Still, I wasn't informed. We thought that formula milk was just as good. I should really have breastfed you. Oh, my word, thinks Grace. Is she drunk? And any other news on Scribbly Gum? Asks Laura. Yes, there is. I'm sorry. I tried to call yesterday, but I couldn't get through on the number on the itinerary. Aunt Connie died. The funeral is tomorrow. There is a sudden hissing silence on the phone. Mum? I'm sorry to break. Her mother's voice overlaps her own. Was it pneumonia? I told her 1,000 times she'd catch pneumonia. She would never wear anything warm around her neck. I gave her a perfectly nice skivvy last Easter. She acted all hoity-toity about it. She said, would you wear this, Laura? And I said, well, I might if I was approaching 90, Connie. It wasn't pneumonia. She just died in her sleep. Aunt Margie found her. They all think she knew she was going to die. She had all her papers in a pile next to her bed. I suppose I'd better call. How are they taking it? Grandma Enigma has been crying a lot. I can imagine. says Laura disgustedly, sounding more like herself again. Mum likes to cry. I've tried to tell Margie that. The other news is that apparently Aunt Connie has left her house to Thomas's ex-girlfriend, Sophie. Aunt Rose told Thomas. There was a letter for her.
Oh, that's contemptible. That is just so Connie.
Veronica wants to contest the will.
Good for her. Someone should stand up to Connie. She's been bossing this family around for far too long.
Yes, well, she's dead now, Mum. She's not going to be bossing us around any longer.
Laura says, but Sophie's the one who left poor Thomas at the altar.
Not exactly at the altar.
How very tactless of Connie.
Seeing as her mother had once told Thomas to stop being such a soppy sap when he was grieving over Sophie, Grace doesn't think she is qualified to give a lecture on tact. She changes the subject. Veronica thinks that Aunt Connie always knew the secret of what happened to Alice and Jack. She thinks the secret will die with her.
Oh, Alice and Jack, says Laura dismissively. Do you know, I'm so bored with the whole Alice and Jack business. Traveling has really put things like that in perspective for me. All my life, Alice and Jack, Alice and Jack. I'll tell you what happened to Alice and Jack.
There is another hissing pause, and then Laura says irritably, how old are you?
Sorry?
You're 34, aren't you?
Yes. What's that got to do with anything?
Oh, I don't know. Look, Alice and Jack is a business. A profitable business, which we've all done very well out of. I'll give Connie that. And, as she always said, if the mystery was solved, it would be bad for business. There is probably some dull solution, but who really cares? Veronica cares. She's always cared. And now she wants to write a book about it. No doubt she'll find some new project before she gets past the first chapter.
It's true that over the last 3 years, Veronica has started 3 different university degrees, a novel, 6 new jobs, a children's book to rival Harry Potter, dozens of community college courses, a pet washing business, and a clear your clutter consultancy. Veronica has always been flighty, but since her divorce, she has become quite frenzied.
Probably. Oh, shit, this ridiculous phone card is...
The line goes dead. Grace hangs up. That had been a very strange phone call. Her mother had sworn, too.
The shit had been just as out of character as the oh my word. What did she say?
Calls out Callum from the living room. There is plenty of material from the conversation that Callum would enjoy hearing. The tomatoes, the Turkish toilets, Aunt Connie's skivvy, the implication that Laura knows more about the Alice and Jack mystery. He comes into the hallway and looks down at her eagerly. Grace feels her head begin to cave in again with that horrendous headache. It is just too much effort to be funny and entertaining and loving. It's just too much effort to talk, really.
What's the gossip?
Nothing, she says. I'm going to have a bath.
Chapter 18. A thin layer of frost makes the scribbly gum wharf glitter in the sun. The island is closed for business. Family members still on the island are catching the ferry across for Aunt Connie's funeral.
Oh, would you just look at him?
Clucks Grace's Aunt Margie, peering into the stroller at Jake, who stares back at her solemnly, his chin wet with dribble.
He looks adorable. You dress him so beautifully, Grace. Of course, you dress yourself so beautifully, too. You get it from your mother. I'm afraid I have no style whatsoever. Do I, Ron?
Her husband, immaculate in a dark suit and dark glasses, stops his pacing up and down on the wharf. I'm assuming you don't actually require an answer to that inane question, Margaret. Good morning, Grace. When Grace was a child, she thought her Uncle Ron, so handsome and debonair, so cleverly sarcastic, was exactly the sort of man she would like to marry one day. When she got older, she decided he wasn't clever at all, he was just nasty, and Margie was a stupid fool for putting up with it. Now, she just accepts them. After all, Thomas and Veronica don't appear at all concerned by their parents' relationship. Every marriage, every family, has its mysteries. "You look very stylish, Aunt Margie," says Grace. In fact, Margie looks her usual frumpy, cuddly self. She is wearing a white blouse and a black skirt, straining valiantly to hold her in. "It's hard to know what to wear to a funeral these days," says Margie. "Everything is so much more casual. You don't think I look like a cocktail waitress, do you, Grace, darling?"
"Not in the slightest."
Grace thinks that Margie actually looks like a lovable diner waitress in an American Road movie. All she needs is the pot of coffee and some gum.
"I've been going to my Weight Watchers quite regularly," confides Margie breathily, leaning forward while her eyes dart over to her husband.
"Your mother will be relieved. She thinks I'm grossly overweight." Grace looks at her aunt's carefully made-up face, brown foundation collecting in the pores of her nose.
"Oh, no, I'm sure she doesn't," she says finally, wondering if she waited too long to answer.
She has a strange, not unpleasant sense of disconnection from everyone, as if she is floating somewhere high above her head and operating her body by remote control. Stretch lips to smile. Fold palms of hands around pram handle. Tip head towards child in motherly fashion. The night before, Jake had woken up at 1 a.m. and refused to settle after his feed. He would pretend it was his intention to go to sleep, and then all of a sudden he'd give a violent shudder and scream furiously, his face bright red and wrinkled tightly like a walnut. Grace had turned on lights and paced the house, grimly rocking the baby as she walked around the perimeter of each room, upstairs and downstairs. When her route took her past the main bedroom, she would see the silhouette of Callum, asleep, flat on his back, snoring blissfully. It was because he'd drunk red wine at dinner. It always made him sleep like a corpse. He would have wanted Grace to wake him, but she preferred to play the martyr. She was the mother. It was her job. It was her duty. It was her punishment. Oh, God knew what terrible crime she'd committed. At 5:30 in the morning, Grace looked down and realized that the baby had finally fallen asleep, frowning deeply, his cupid's bow lips slack. Grace had got back into bed beside Callum and stared with burning, dry eyes at the ceiling until 7, when Callum had sleepily rolled onto his side, pulling her to him, asking, "Did you sleep well?"
"You look a little pale, darling," says Margie. "How's the baby sleeping?"
"Beautifully," answered Grace. She steals Callum's joke.
"Like a baby." "Like a baby," giggles Margie. "Oh, that's a good one, Grace."
Grace tries to laugh and is horrified at the weird sound that comes out of her mouth. But Margie doesn't seem to notice. She imagines telling Margie the truth.
"Here's the thing, Aunt Margie. It's just that I really, truly don't like being a mother.
It's not that I'm tired or a bit emotional. It's just not the job for me. It's not that I'm having a few problems bonding with my baby. I don't even like him. I feel nothing. I want out. Oh, please, please, I want out. Margie sighs and tugs at the waistband of her skirt. She glances at her husband, who is standing at the end of the wharf, his back very straight, one hand shading his eyes, looking out for the ferry. She smiles brightly back at Grace and shivers theatrically. Isn't it cold? It was quite hot on Tuesday. It's been such a funny old winter, hasn't it? Well, darling, I think it's going to be a really lovely funeral. We've done everything just as she wanted. Not that Connie left anything to chance. She had a manila folder with step-by-step instructions. It's called Instructions for My Funeral. She's practically done all the catering for her own funeral, you know. That freezer of hers. Oh, I'm going to miss her so much. I don't know how the island is going to get by without her. I thought we'd have her for another 10 years, at least. Oh, my. Would you look at what they're wearing? Grace looks up to see her grandmother and Aunt Rose coming down the hill, the two of them sitting erect on their mobility aid scooters. There's a missing space where Connie should have been. It was normally Enigma, Rose, and Connie, three abreast, although with Connie just slightly ahead. They were like an elderly biker gang, zooming around the island's one road, going as fast as the bikes would let them. Which was pretty fast, because one day Connie had called up one of Jimmy's nephews, who was a mechanic, and said, "I want you to hot up our bikes for us, Sam. They're too slow. It drives me mad." Sam had responded to the challenge with alacrity, replacing the engines with ones from lawnmowers. Connie had given him a high five the first time she revved up her new engine. "We're real hoons," Grandma Enigma always said. "We hoon around the place." Enigma really enjoyed saying the word hoon. "The wharf might be slippery," cries out Margie frantically. "It's frosty. Be careful, Mum. Rose. Oh, why must they always go so fast?" "Oh, relax, darling." Enigma comes to a neat stop next to them. "My word, it's chilly. But otherwise a lovely day for it, isn't it?" "I must say you two look very colourful," says Ron. Enigma, who comes up to Ron's waist, is wearing a fire engine red jacket with a diagonally striped shirt. With her short, permed, purplish-grey hair and apple-pink cheeks, she looks like a brightly wrapped lolly. Rose is tall and ethereal, with long, impractical white hair that she still wears the same way she wore it when she was 16, clasped at the back with the same tortoiseshell hair clip. For Connie's funeral, she is wearing a gorgeously coloured turquoise suit with a matching long filmy scarf that changes from blue to green in the sun. She has tied a piece of the same material around her walking frame. Actually, they look quite presentable. Grace knew Margie had been worried they'd have flowers or birds painted on their faces, which did cause people to stare. "Yes, we do look colourful," says Enigma snappishly. She doesn't take any rubbish from her son-in-law. "That's because we're celebrating Connie's wonderful, colourful life." "Colourful," says Ron. "That's an interesting choice of word, Enigma. Makes it sound like Connie might have rather unsavoury secrets in her past." There is a moment of strange, loaded silence. Margie wrings her hands. Enigma punches her fists into her sides and narrows her eyes ferociously. Rose's nostrils become pinched and regal. What a remarkably inappropriate thing to say, she announces with devastating disdain, and gives Ron a look as if he were a filthy boy, caught in the act of doing something truly repugnant. It is always interesting to see Rose switch from vague and dreamy to crushing and cold, unless, of course, you are on the receiving end, which Grace had been occasionally when she was a teenager, especially when she went through her brief but memorable pierced nose and shaved head stage. My sincerest apologies, Rose. Ron is as smooth as expensive liqueur. You're right. It was a poor attempt at humor. I should leave the jokes to my witty wife. Shouldn't I, Margie? Chapter 19. The morning of Aunt Connie's funeral, there is frost on the grass outside Sophie's flat. Sophie, Sophie, Jack Frost has been! Gretel used to call on mornings like this, with such excitement in her voice that Sophie would leap from her bed and run to her window to see their white-spangled front lawn. Sophie had believed in Jack Frost, the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny for an embarrassingly long time. It was her mother's fault. She was too good an actress. For example, she described accidentally running into Santa Claus one night in the kitchen when she went to get a glass of water in such authentic-sounding detail. Santa had had such a fright that he'd said, "Lordy me," and had to sit down and have a Milo and an iced Vovo. He'd got crumbs in his beard. From outside on the driveway, Gretel could hear the sleigh bells jingling in the breeze and the reindeers snorting and pounding their hooves. On Christmas Eve and frosty mornings, Sophie still feels a faint shivery tingle of that old magic. It makes her feel better as she eats her porridge. Aunt Connie's funeral seems like some sort of horrible public humiliation test. She wears the black dress because Claire had been so adamant that it was right. Sophie has lost all confidence over what is right or wrong about this whole thing. The funeral is at noon at Glass Bay. She plans to go into work for a couple of hours and then catch a train from the city to Glass Bay, where she can get a cab to the church. She has allowed an hour and a half to give herself plenty of time. Timing is crucial. Too early will appear too eager. Okay, let's get this over with so I can get my hands on the old biddy's house. Too late will appear blasé, just dropping by to pay my respects. By the way, where are the keys to this house I've been hearing about? In the end, she is running late. A girl tumbles excited into Sophie's office to make a report of sexual harassment. She has clearly not been sexually harassed. You should be so lucky, Sophie catches herself thinking rather unprofessionally, but these things must be gently diffused like a ticking explosive device. Then the train stops inexplicably for 20 minutes in between stations. By the time she gets to Glass Bay and she is pelting up the stairs in her stilettos, she is hyperventilating with a mix of guilt and nerves. There are pounding footsteps behind her, and a man in a suit is suddenly running by her side. "You're not going to Connie Doughty's funeral, are you?" "Yes, I am," she says breathlessly as they both keep running. "Me too," he says. "We'll share a cab then." "That train, could you believe it? I was bashing my head against the window." Sophie laughs. "I was thumping my fist against the seat in front of me." She manages to get a fleeting impression of a big nose and deep laugh lines. He is running easily, his briefcase held under one arm. "Stop it," she thinks. "Stop it. It's not him. If you think it's him, it won't be him." "Here's one." She watches him run ahead and flag down a cab. "Nice square, broad back. Stop it." He turns around and smiles at her. Our luck's changing.
Well, mine certainly is.
His smile is funny and friendly and sexy all at once.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!
He opens the cab door for her and she slides across the seat. He hops in beside her and gives the cabbie the address of the church. It seems like the space in the back of the cab is very small and intimate. She can smell his aftershave. As he pulls back his sleeve to check the time, she can see his very masculine-looking forearm. Oh, for heaven's sake, Sophie!
Well, hello, she says. She can feel her smile is radiant and possibly beautiful.
I'm Sophie Honeywell.
Aha, he says. He raises one quizzical eyebrow, James Bond style. He really is extraordinarily sexy.
So you're Sophie.
Oh, God, it seems like it has been years since the last time she has felt this. Instant mutual attraction. She is not imagining this. Chemistry is frothing and fizzing all over the place. She can feel it in her kneecaps. He reaches out to shake her hand.
Hello, Sophie.
Sophie puts her hand in his, warm, dry, enfolding hers. She lets her eyes drop to her watch. It's 5 to noon. I knew the moment we sat in the cab and your father shook my hand. It was 5 to noon on Thursday, the 2nd of...
I'm Callum, he says. Callum Tidyman. Grace's husband.
Chapter 20. Rose sits right at the end of the front pew of the church, next to the aisle, with her walking stick propped up beside her. The seat offers no support for the lower back, and already she can feel a stabbing pain.
Oh, sugar!
It hurts. It really hurts. She has to stop herself from crying out, that's how much it hurts. If her back had ever hurt like this when she was 20, she would have been hysterical, demanding painkillers and cups of tea in bed. But she has found that nobody is especially surprised to hear you're in pain when you're in your 80s. You might find it astonishing, but nobody else does. People are murmuring to each other, or sitting silently, hands clasped carefully on their laps, looking self-consciously solemn. Occasionally there is a hollow-sounding cough. Funerals all have the same smells and sounds. The cloying, nose-twitching scent of lilies. That muted rustling. Sometimes a sudden, shocking, uncontrollable sobbing. Although there is not much sobbing at the funerals Rose seems to spend so much of her time attending these days. People would consider it excessive and rather Italian if you started wailing at the death of an elderly person. Instead, you say things like, well, he had a good innings, didn't he? No surprise you're in pain. No surprise you're dead. You're old. That is what is meant to happen. We don't care that you forget you're old. We know you're old. Rose thinks of that poem she used to like and is pleased with herself when she can remember the first few lines. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. That's right, she thinks. We should all be raging and raving and brandishing our walking sticks. We don't want to go. And by the way, we want our legs and arms and backs to stop hurting. She will ask Thomas to find the rest of that poem on the internet for her. He can find anything on his lap computer. He's a sweet boy, Thomas,
Such a pity it didn't work out with Sophie. They'd all liked Sophie.
What's the hold-up? It's so chilly in here.
Enigma is sitting on Rose's left, jiggling around in her bright red outfit. Her feet don't quite touch the ground. When Rose looks straight ahead, she can almost believe that it's still a little girl sitting next to her. Not a 72-year-old Enigma.
Rose, isn't it cold? You'd think they'd have a heater. No need to make us feel like we're in a morgue just because we're in a funeral, eh? Rose?
Rose ignores her. She doesn't feel like talking. Enigma makes an offended sound and turns to talk to Margie, who is sitting on her other side and never ignores her mother. Rose and Connie had chuckled, just last week it was, about how funerals had become their new hobby. Throughout their lives, they'd taken up various convivial pastimes together. Tennis, art classes, lawn bowls. Now they'd taken up funerals. Their friends had got so old that whenever Connie bought a get-well card, she also bought a sympathy card at the same time to save herself the trouble of going back to the newsagent when they didn't get well. Rose had thought that was just terrible, but Connie always liked to be the practical one. The light inside the church is like twilight, shadowy and strange, making it hard for Rose's eyes to distinguish anything except the giant stained glass picture at the front, which makes her flinch with its assault of colour, ruby, emerald, and sapphire. The picture features a handsome, melancholy Jesus stretching out an imperious, drooping hand to his poor mother, who kneels distraught at his feet. Both Jesus and Mary have glowing circles around their heads, like psychedelic motorcycle helmets, and they're surrounded by macabre, baby-faced angels. Why did you want a church, Connie? Is this your last shot at pretending we're good Catholic girls? It is unbearable to think that she won't ever hear Connie's acerbic response. Above the stained glass, there is a window revealing a square of pale blue sky and a wispy cloud. The sky looks comfortingly mundane compared to the garish kaleidoscope of the stained glass. It makes Rose yearn to be reliving any one of a thousand ordinary days spent with her ordinary older sister, who has now done this extraordinary thing and died. A lifetime of ordinary moments crowd her head. Teenagers, sitting in a train station, picking at the green, peeling paint of their chair and bickering desultorily over something to do with a pair of shoes. In their 40s, driving somewhere, running late, looking for a parking spot. There, to your right. Too late, you ninny! Little girls fishing off Sultana rocks. Connie holding a frenzied, flapping, slimy silverfish trapped with her foot, while Rose crouched down to remove the hook, saying, "I'm sorry," to the begging for mercy eye. Whole afternoons with baby Enigma on that old red checked rug in the backyard.